This podcast is primarily recorded on the traditional territories of the Huron-Wendat and Haudenosaunee peoples, in Cataraqui, or Kingston by its colonial name. We center the rightful stewards of this land in order to unsettle our fight for collective liberation. Hello and welcome to another episode of Queer Muslim Resistance, a podcast from Opir Kingston. I'm one of your hosts, Maha, and today I am so excited to speak with Ismet, a queer Muslim based in North Carolina and Catawba land. We have a conversation about revolutionary politics and what it means to learn and unlearn as queer Muslims. We are always looking for queer Muslim guests to feature on the podcast. Check out our very first post on Instagram for more details on how to get involved, or send us a DM on Instagram, or email us at queermuslimresistance@gmail.com. Hi, Asalaamu Alaikum.
Wa Alaikum Asalaam, how are you?
I'm good, thank you. How are you, Ismet?
I'm doing great. I'm really excited. I'm kind of nervous, but I'm here and I'm excited to get this started.
Yeah, me too. Thank you for being here today.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for having me. I'm really honored.
Yeah, of course. So before we get started, we need to do the background stuff. So let's go over your name, your pronouns, your background, where you're based, and whatever else you'd like to share.
So my name is Ismet, or Ismet. I use they, them pronouns. I'm queer, non-binary, gender fluid, I'm Muslim, Palestinian, and a revolutionary, and I choose this identity for myself for multiple reasons that we can also discuss. I'm based in North Carolina, which is Catawba land. I was born in a Gulf country, and I lived there my whole, like, most of my life. Mm-hmm. I moved to the United States in about 8 years ago. And I was in high school. So when I came here, I was in high school. As far as academics, I'm a sex educator. I'm a kindergarten teacher. I'm a public health researcher. I'm a writer. And I like to say that I'm also a storyteller and an artist. And yeah, that's a little bit of myself.
That's awesome. So you said you were a revolutionary. I'm kind of interested in learning a little bit more about, like, how you were radicalized.
When I was in college, I was part of a sex education group, like a peer sex ed group. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the work that I did was around like sex with a trans partner, queer sex ed, and things like that. Mm-hmm. And really, there was a realization, like, during my work that queering sex education was something that was needed for everybody, not just trans or gender non-conforming people or gender fluid people or whatever, that it was needed for everybody, even cis straight people, even if they don't have a trans partner. Like, everybody needed that. And the reason being was that we are taught gender at a very young age, and with gender comes body. And, like, being told, for me, in my experience, being told that, like, my private parts were, like, bad, dirty, shouldn't be touched or looked at, and then growing older and learning about, like, self-pleasure and masturbation, and then still being told that, you know, your body, like, your private parts should not be touched until you get married. Mm-hmm. It's just for peeing, it's just for using the bathroom, nothing else. And and then also learning about, I took a gender woman gender studies course. It was an introduction course, and I really, like, I learned so much in that class. But in that class also, we talked about intersex people and how deciding the gender of the baby based on, like, their penis or clitoris, and, like, if it's large enough or small enough, and whether, like, this baby can have sex in, like, be in a heterosexual relationship, would have intercourse in that way when they're older. And just, like, coming across all of this stuff, like, at once, or maybe not at once, but being part of this peer sex education group really put me in that place where I could, like, explore more of those topics. I was just kind of like, hold up, like, look at the way, like, this propaganda is everywhere about, like, for Black and brown people, for fat people, for trans people, for people who don't have, like, the, like, normal quote-unquote body type or the ideal body type, that if you don't have that body type, if you don't have this skin color, this whatever, then you're undeserving of good sex. you're undeserving of pleasure, you're undeserving of a good relationship. And so that was really just like my very first introduction that started like to radicalize me and just get me to see the world from a colonial lens, just regarding gender roles and whatnot. So that also relates to me being non-binary and how I decided to call myself non-binary. So talking again about this queer sex ed group, like, it was a great community, and our advisor, I was very close with her, and she was, I mean, she was awesome. And she was also the person who helped me explore more about my gender identity. So I was very uncomfortable with she, her pronouns, and just questioning whether or not I was a boy. I was like, I'm not a boy, but I'm not a girl either. And then I was like, I don't want to deal with this. It's too much. It's overwhelming, but I'm still uncomfortable with she, her pronouns. And so I started using she, they pronouns. And people still use she, her pronouns for me because, you know, I look feminine or whatever, whatever that means. And then once I got this confidence in me to ask people around me to use they and them pronouns for me, I was like, okay, like, this is nice. Like, I'm really comfortable here, but I still didn't call myself non-binary. Once I dated another non-binary person, they were also a non-binary Muslim, and one time they said this thing. They were like, this is my first time dating a non-binary person. And I was like, hold up. I was like, number one, me neither. I've never dated another non-binary person before. And number two, like, I am non-binary. Like, I was just like, I didn't like think about it like that. And this non-binary person that I was dating wasn't like white, wasn't thin, wasn't like a traditional or like, you know, just like looking up a non-binary person or just like non-binary people on YouTube or whatever, they all look the same way. And I was like, I don't look this way. I wear a hijab. I'm not necessarily thin. I'm Muslim. I'm all of those things. Mm-hmm. So it was really nice to hear that for the first time. And then realizing that I'm like, that was like my realization. I was like, yes, I'm non-binary. So that was really cool. Another thing also is just regarding my mental health lately hasn't been the greatest. Yeah. And I was really questioning why I was so miserable. Mm-hmm. And I was like looking around me, I'm just seeing how much there's injustice in the world around me. Mm-hmm. And that was awful. Like, it was just, it made me really sad all the time. Injustice that I see around me in people I love, injustice in the world, and also injustice towards myself because of the environment that I'm living in, those expectations, the traditional expectations that are expected of me. Mm-hmm. So there was a lot of injustice that I saw, and it made me really, really depressed. So seeing all of that, and then also coming to a realization that this world wasn't built for me, like the world that I live in, that this capitalist society was not built for me. It's not meant for me. And that's why I'm not functioning well in it, because it wasn't meant for me. So those things that I came across really pushed me to become more radical as far as like just my political thought, my political ideology, and seeing how what the world looks like and what my place is in the world. What do I want to do? What do I want to change? Because it's not enough to just do acknowledgements or whatever. We need action. Mm-hmm. So there's another event that I wanted to talk about, and that's the New Zealand shooting that happened last March. So that was really shocking when it happened. And then a month after, there was a shooting at my school where two students had died, and I was on campus when it happened, and that was also like really shocking. And it was very, very, very upsetting to hear people talk about, you know, the cops, you know, thank the cops for doing their job. Thankfully they were there on time. You know, guns, we shouldn't, whatever. And personally, I'm uncomfortable with the idea of like cops being armed while civilians are not. And that's for the reasons of self-defense. So seeing all of that, like, I'm like, people died, and I blame white supremacy. I blame capitalism. I blame this world that promises white men, you know, this wealth, this fame, this, all of those things. And then when they do the wrong thing or whatever, there isn't resources for them or whatever. And then, like, it's like, oh, mental health issues or whatever. They don't even, like, call them terrorists for, like, distributing terror in, around the people. And, like, I'm not even comfortable calling them terrorists, but that's, like, another conversation. I'm getting off topic. But the day after this shooting, I was, I had been planning to wear a Palestinian dress to school, and I was really nervous about it. But then the shooting happened, and then I went to class. I wanted to wear it anyway because I was like, that was kind of like my political statement, because people are going to be looking at me. My campus is kind of like semi-conservative, and people are open with their political ideology. And there's a lot of conservatives and also a lot of liberals who not a fan of either. But when I went to school, even though I was getting looks and whatever, like, me wearing this dress is like my fuck you to the world and to every single one of you who is like letting this happen. So that was really powerful to me, wearing a Palestinian dress to school. And it really, those like two experiences happening like right after each other really shaped my identity, like identifying as Muslim openly and wearing hijab openly. Anyone who looks at me will, you know, tell I'm Muslim, obviously. But just like being proud of it, which is something I also struggled with at some point, you know, wearing hijab in public and things like that, especially like moving from a Muslim country where everyone wears hijab, or most people do, and then moving to a country where people think it's bad and I'm oppressed or whatever. So that really like shaped my experience and kind of my understanding of like Islamophobia in this country or in the West, how like it stems from anti-blackness, and it stems from this division and kind of like us versus them mentality.
You said Islamophobia stems from anti-blackness. Do you mind expanding on that a little bit?
Yeah, so the way within like colonial history, white people have invaded the different parts of Africa and Middle East, and, you know, taking people as slaves to the New World. And so since the very start, the basis of this country, it was white versus black, right? Even within European people, some European people were considered like the other, like, quote unquote. I can't say which specifically because I don't know. But I know there was a lot of divisions even within European people, that some of them were like lower, some of them were seen as working class or whatever, even though there is no white working class or whatever. But it was always like black versus white, right? And then when other nations became immigrating, and this is also the, what is it called? Like the Asian role model or whatever.
The model minority.
Yes, the model minority. Mm-hmm. So even petting people, like petting minorities against each other. And then when Islam has a huge history in America, within Black America also, mm-hmm. Since slavery, since those times. And so, this hate towards any other or any minority stems from anti-Blackness, because that's the basis of racism mm-hmm. in this country. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Thank mm-hmm. you. What did your introduction to Islam look like?
So I can't say for specifically because I, like, growing up, I was always told I'm Muslim. So I always, like, since I remember, like, opening my eyes to the world or whatever, I remember being Muslim always, being taught by my parents, like, you're Muslim, you're Palestinian, you're from this place in Palestine, you are from... we are Sunni. That's like really important. And so being told, like being taught those things at a very young age, and also like I was raised in a religious household, so a lot of Quran, studying and teaching and memorization, a lot of hadith at a young age. So a lot of it was like that, and it was a very set image of what Islam should look like at a young age. And even like moving to this country has really altered the way that I realize Islam is practiced in different ways. So that's something I didn't see before. And also my brother is like a year younger than me, or a year and a half younger than me. So since a young age, I was also taught gender. Looking at my body and my brother's body at the time, just seeing how we're different, and then being told that at a certain age, you cannot change in the same room. You cannot shower at the same time. You cannot, you cannot sit like this. And then him, like, just seeing those differences in the way we were treated, the way we were. So I was taught gender like at a very young age. And I remember specifically also one day I was talking about Allah, and my parents said something about Allah being like having no gender. Mm-hmm. And I was so confused, because I was like, it's either girl or boy, right? Mm-hmm. I was like, what do you mean no gender? And they were like, yeah, like Allah uses he, him pronouns, but he has no gender. He's not a boy or a girl. And more recently, my dad was like going off about like non-binary people. How can they have no gender? How can you not be a girl or boy? And I was like, why is the concept so foreign to you, if you're the one who taught me that Allah and like the angels don't have a gender? Mm-hmm. So like there are like non-binary, and but we use like this, it's so like, excuse me, it's so like basic or like direct or like straightforward. Like, why is it so like foreign mm-hmm. to you? Why is the concept so hard to like understand? But I think that has to do also with the fluidity of Islam, and how like colonialism has also ruined Islam for us. Yeah. Or the way I see it is because of the people it was passed down to. But I can I'm gonna cover this in a little bit. But yeah, also just being introduced to that concept was kind of conflicting, like for me at that age, just being confused about it. Like, how can Allah have no gender? Like, you were the one who taught me that it's two genders, you know?
Yeah, yeah. And then how has your experience changed since you were younger with Islam? Has it changed?
It has changed drastically. So I had a conversation with a convert, a Muslim convert last year, and I was just kind of telling her, I was kind of coming after her, but not. Mm-hmm. And I was telling her like how I was struggling with my religion. I wasn't praying anymore. Like Quran wasn't bringing me peace anymore. And she was telling me how I asked her, I was like, why do you pray? Like, why do you do this? And she was like, I don't know, like, if Islam is the right religion. I don't know for certain that it's the right religion. But what I do know is that prayer brings me peace and tranquility. And that, like really opened my eyes. I was like, so I don't have to, like, because, like, growing up, like, it's always been, like, Islam is the religion. It's that's mm-hmm. it, period. Like there is no room for other discussion. There is no room for nothing. Mm-hmm. So it is possible to be Muslim and also be uncertain about it. Like to be like, maybe Islam is not the right, maybe it's just, because I've had those uncertainties for, you know, just growing up and stuff. I've had those uncertainties about, well, what if Islam is just like other religions? Like the way, like when you argue with a Christian, because my parents, since moving here, like when they knock at your door, like my parents have always been the type to like welcome them in and like argue with them. So like arguing with them, I saw that they truly believe their religion is the right religion. I'm like, we truly believe that our religion is the right religion. So like, what if it's not? And so hearing her say that, like, yeah, like I don't know if Islam is the right religion, but I do know that prayer brings me peace. I was like, yeah, like it's like, and I, it's just really like inspiring to me, or not like necessarily inspiring, but I don't know what the word I'm looking for. It just really, like, brought me a lot of happiness and joy to, like, hear her say that. I was like, oh, like, there's another way to, to practice that that doesn't, like, I can't practice without, like, being 100% certain. Like, that's an option, too. So that was really eye-opening. And I think the way I describe my gender as gender fluid, and I think it really ties in with the fluidity in religion, which is something I discovered, like, kind of on my own, just how you can practice it however you want. Really, it's very personal. It's your relationship with Allah. Like, if you want to pray without a hijab, that's cool. If you want to pray without wudu, that's cool. If you want to pray in the wrong qibla, like, that's cool. At least you're praying. At least you're doing it. If you want to fast with some water, if you want to fast at a certain time, that's cool. It's between you and Allah. Like, nobody is really gonna be like, I mean, yes, people will say stuff, but the reality is that it's your relationship with Allah is similar to any other relationship that you have with anybody else. So I like to describe my Islam as being fluid as well. I remember also in 2016 when I was very conflicted just with my sexuality and my religion, but I remember being conflicted at that time, and a friend had introduced me to Queer Jihad, which is this series of books and a website for LGBTQ Muslims. And I remember reading on the website that you cannot worship Allah while being, like, at war with yourself. And that was, like, so, like, it was kind of like a shocker for me, because I was like, dang, like, this is why it hasn't been working. This is why I've been trying to pray, trying to, like, connect, but it's not working. It's because I'm so conflicted with myself. Like, I don't have to be conflicted with myself in that way. Like, why don't I just chill? Like, yeah. And this is my interpretation of the Quran also. Because you see the way that the old shuyukh, how can you give a ruling about trans people or gay people if you haven't experienced it yourself? If all your life you have been certain about your gender and sexuality, you cannot give a ruling about for somebody who has been uncertain. You cannot do that. So I see this, if all the shuyukh have been heterosexual men, and also a lot of them, most of them are Arab too, so a lot of them also heterosexual cis men, they don't know what it's like to experience this otherwise, how are they going to give the true ruling for marginalized Muslims? And so this was my understanding also of Islam right now, or certain way that it was taught. I'm not going to say right now, because I know other people practice it differently, but the way I was raised about it also, it looks a specific way because it was passed down a specific way, because the people who interpret it a specific way were specific people. And I remember also, this is something I wanted to mention earlier, being introduced to, like, Shia hate at home, not at school, because it came up at school in third grade, I remember very specifically, and the teacher said, we're all Muslim, we all love each other, it doesn't matter if you're Shia or Sunni or whatever. And then I went home and I said to my parents, and they were like, oh no, Shia people are this and this and that. And I was like, that was, like, something I looked back on, like, in, like, after a while, I was like, oh, like, so, like, the way my parents taught me is not necessarily the right way. Like, those are all realizations that, you know, even though, like, and I miss that certainty, being certain. It's so nice to feel secure and certain in your religion, in your life. And I really miss it. But at the same time, I'm glad that I broke away from it. You know what I mean? Uncertainty can be hurtful sometimes. It can hurt. It can cause pain. As you figure it out, but I'm glad that I broke away from that that certainty of the wrong thing, that or the hurtful thing, for sure. And additionally, with my Islam, is thinking about true Islam as fighting for the oppressed, to liberate ourselves, to liberate our people. And, you know, there's so many examples in the Quran against oppression, that, you know, you're allowed to fight those who fought you. You're allowed to defend yourself. You should fight for the poor. You should fight. Unlike things that my parents have told me when they see like a homeless person, like, oh, beggars are the worst thing ever. The worst thing you can do is beg for money or whatever. Or just thinking about people who don't have jobs or things like that. Like my parents, I mean, thankfully I have been, you know, privileged of, you know, the security, or my parents haven't really had those times when they were in the position like that. So that was, I'm thankful for that, but at the same time, it doesn't give my parents a full picture. So those are arguments or things that discussions I get into with my parents frequently. So thinking about Islam in that way really fuels my work, fuels my my desire to change things or change my reality.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for sharing. I loved everything you said. Everything's just resonating with me a lot. So thank you.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So in our previous correspondence, you said that your fight to free Palestine begins here, where you're based, on Catawba land or North Carolina. Why is it so imperative to center the here and now in our struggles for a then and there?
Because honestly, when else are you going to do it?
Mm-hmm.
And where else, if it's not the place you visit frequently, you know, if this revolution is going to happen through the masses, and the masses are people who are working, who are struggling every day to pay their bills, to keep the roof over their head, to keep the food on the table. This is the everyday people. This is the strength of the masses that you want to bring together. You need the unity of the masses. You need the people on the ground. And if it's not now, because look around you, the world is changing. And if I would argue that a symptom of capitalism is that people are going to rise up, because it doesn't work for us.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't represent us. So it's only natural that we do rise up against this evil force. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And my connection to this land specifically is of solidarity and community resistance, because in Palestine, I'm not in Palestine. I cannot fight in the same way for Palestine that I do here.
Mm-hmm.
But what I see is that we have the same struggle, and it's the struggle against imperialism. So we have the same enemy. We are fighting for the same cause, and eventually the liberation of this land will mean the liberation of Palestine. So I'm fighting for the people of the Turtle Island, and in the same way that I fight there, it's the first step to freeing Palestine in my view. So this is the importance of community and the unity of our community. Like, you want unity among the people. So I do have a comment about those protests for all our listeners. Do not go to the protests. Do not go to the protest, because you are putting yourself and your life in danger. So what you want to do is you want to educate yourself politically, be educated, be prepared, find your community, strengthen your community, strengthen your people, be able to defend yourself, all of those things before you strike. And you want to strike when the kingdom, this empire, this imperial force is at its weakest. So what we can do right now is strengthen ourselves, instead of, because if you're protesting, you could get snatched, you could get beaten, you could get burned, you could get, so many things could happen to you if you don't have a plan.
Mm-hmm.
And your plan should include security, transportation, all those different things. And so please don't go to the protest, because it's really putting your life at danger.
Mm-hmm.
But what you can do right now is build your community, become stronger, find the unity of the people, and join a revolutionary organization, or find a community, find people of revolutionary mindset, find an organization that's doing the work.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of putting your life at danger. Because if you look around you, the world is changing, and we need to question ourselves and see where we are in this, because this is historical events, you know what I mean? We are really going to change the future for ourselves, and we want to build a better future for ourselves. So we need to question ourselves and not be adventurous in our actions, be really organized, because as I consider myself in my revolutionary terms, historian or a scientist, and what that means is I want to look at past revolutionaries and see where they succeeded, where they failed. So if a lot of them also, a lot of them will tell you, this is how we lost Palestine, is by disorganization. We weren't organized. We didn't expect the enemy to strike. And so we weren't organized and prepared for it. While they were prepared, they were, they had everything, you know, their power, the arms, the people, they had everything on their side. We weren't prepared, and we, well, all we did was protest demonstrations that weren't really organized, weren't really with a goal. They weren't really just not organized. Mm-hmm. And that's what lost us our land. So as a historian, as a scientist, we need to look at past revolutionaries and learn from them and make it fit and adapt. So materially, what works, what doesn't, and move forward from there.
Mm-hmm. That's definitely something I haven't thought about before in terms of like protesting at the right times, or not the right times necessarily, but like, yeah, just there's a lot to think about there. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
I think because it makes sense that people want to go out and protest. It makes sense because that's definitely something I wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
But since becoming part of a revolutionary organization or being among a revolutionary mindset, and getting this political education that I need, I'm learning and studying more history, revolutionaries, and seeing again what worked and what didn't. Mm-hmm. And that's something that's really important to do, because the revolution is not. It's not adventurous. It's not whatever. It didn't just happen. Revolution is very organized and it's continuous. So it's happening right now. It's going to, we're just at different stages is what I would say. At different stages.
Thank you for that.
Mm-hmm.
So we exist in relation to the land. What does this mutuality, this reciprocity mean to you as a queer Muslim Palestinian based where you are?
So for me, it will extend even beyond the land itself.
Mm-hmm.
It's international solidarity among all colonized people. And because we are fighting for the self-determination for the people of this, like I'm fighting for the self-determination or sovereignty of the people native to the Turtle Island. So we want to build a future where nobody is living at the expense of another. I believe that our relationships within one another is rooted in our relationship to the land. So this land is not like a piece of just a piece of land that you sign a contract or you write a paper, whatever. It's more. It's much more than that. You grow together. If you treat the land with vile or evil intentions, the land will give that back to you.
Mm-hmm.
If you treat the land with love, with the intention of growth, with the intention of community, the land will give back to you as well.
Mm-hmm.
So you're gonna grow together. This is your relationship to the land, because the land is your environment, your resource for food. It can be your shelter. It can be so many things. And I love the land, like the soil. We want, like, I love gardening. I love planting. I love eating the food, the growing peppers. I grow peppers and different like herbs and pumpkins and things.
Mm-hmm.
So this is our relationship to the land is much more than what they want us to believe or think. And it's something you learn from, and that learns from you contribute to it. That and it benefits you. It's really beautiful. It's a beautiful relationship. It's a beautiful place to be. I believe that as colonized people, we should have full control over our labor, lives, resources, and our land.
Mm-hmm.
And I I feel that being queer and fluid grounds me in my anti-colonial work. Mm-hmm. And that's, again, imagining a future where nobody lives at the expense of another. And being able and to imagine this future and manifest it through, you know, our love, our action, taking, you know, this being able to grow, like growing a garden, that's something that you can do. You know, just caring for the plants. If you walk outside, just being kind to the plants, being in community with the land, and your relationship again with each other as a community, mm-hmm. is also rooted in the land that we live on and rooted in the land that we interact with. So it's really important to like think about the land question and everything that we do, because I'm settling or a settler on this land. It's not my land, but I'm gonna fight for this land as if it's my land. And again, this is my first step to freeing Palestine, because I see this as the same fight.
You said to me previously that together we can outgrow colonialism and all its symptoms, from imperialism to Zionism to sexism, transphobia, Islamophobia, and others. So what role does collective healing have in our revolutions?
So collective healing can also look like forgiveness, mm-hmm. among people. So forgiving yourself, forgiving people you love, and also just learning how to live with one another, interact with one another. There's also unity in collective healing. So in collective healing, we can find unity among ourselves as a community to look at our faults and look at the injustice that has been done against us, whether as a community or as individuals. And collective healing can turn into collective liberation. And I think that idea is so beautiful. Collective healing turning into collective liberation. Mm-hmm. Because our relationships with each other is very critical to having a thriving movement. Because how else is it going to work? You know? The other day I was talking to my boyfriend, and I said to him something about, you know, how at some point in my life I truly, like, genuinely believed that I was meant to be miserable, that some people are just meant to be miserable, and how I was like, I'm really grateful that I was able to experience happiness and that I don't believe in that anymore, that I know I'm capable of love and I'm capable of being loved and I'm capable of being happy. And you know, he said no one is meant to be miserable. And I said, how do you know that? And he said, it's the reason we have other humans. The reason we have other humans is because we cannot make ourselves like miserable. Mm-hmm. We're a community. We live in relationship to each other. Mm-hmm. So what collective healing looks like is bringing together all this pain or all this, whatever negative emotion that you have. Like, I feel like something I'm working on, like, I'm working on healing, because I feel like I have a lot of hate in my heart towards certain, like, people who've done me wrong, or because towards just the world in general. Mm-hmm. But I'm realizing that I cannot function like that. So I'm learning also how to deal with it and how to come face to face with these issues and these injustices. But what it looks like is bringing together all this pain and through a radical approach of community, of love, transforming it into something better and transforming it into a future where nobody lives at the expense of another. Mm-hmm. Additionally, I want to be able to allow myself to fully emerge into healthy relationships that are good for me. I have been in relationships or friendships where people cut me off for no reason, or have been toxic toward me, or wanted to, you know, just said, well, you've done this and that. Well, how do I know that I did it if you didn't communicate it to me? So if I'm holding on to this relationship, I want to teach myself or learn through my community how to forgive. and how to be okay with this, not be okay with it as an accept it, but be okay with the past that has affected me and move on, move forward. So think of it, of the future. And that within, you know, my best friend, some of my professors that I still talk to, my closest friends, my boyfriend, my sisters, my younger sisters are just the best. They're the best. So just learning how to communicate, how to be mature. I don't want to deal. There's no time for me. Like, I don't have the time to deal with childish behavior. You said that, I said that, whatever. Just be direct with somebody if you have an issue with them. Just be straightforward and say, this is my issue. I was annoyed with you because of this. This is not working for me. And giving feedback and being able to say, like, yes, let's moving forward, let's do this. This action or this thing didn't work for me. Let's look at it differently. Let's fix it. Mm-hmm. So this maturity and this communication, it's something I haven't really experienced before. And it's kind of new to me, but I'm really loving it. I'm really happy with the relationship that I have right now, and I don't want to let anybody in who's not mature enough to have a conversation, who's not, you know what I mean? Like, I feel like there's no time for me to deal with any more of that, and it's just time for us to organize and to become stronger, to have unity in our communities. So that's what I wanted to say about it.
Yeah, I love that. I love that you're happy and that you're trying to prioritize joy. I think that's so beautiful and so needed and so necessary.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. So speaking of joy and community, who are your people and how do you love?
So this question was really tough when I first read it, because I was like, I don't know what answer you could be looking for or what is meant by it, because I was like, it feels like such a big question. At the same time, like, I kind of know the answer. So I wanted to say that my people are colonized people, because nobody knows our pain the way we do. Nobody understands what we're going through the way we do. Nobody has really experienced it the way we do. And so for me, being part of this community or this, being part of a revolutionary organization or being part of a community, and beginning this support for my comrades has been invaluable. Mm-hmm. I was going through a rough patch a few weeks ago, and I got so many folks checking up on me. It wasn't just like, hey, I will, if you need anything, let me know. It was people who, like, you could tell that they truly cared. It's not just a text that you sent or something. Like, these people really cared about me. And I was just so touched to know that somebody was, like, looking out for me like that. And I see this also as just growth with, like, just support and growth as a person and as a community. It's just really, like, beautiful, and it's something that I was so happy to experience and to be a part of. I think I want to say that I love unconditionally or freely, and I love through growth. I want to grow with the person I love, and I want them to help me grow. I want this kind of similar to the mutuality with the land, you know, this relationship where it's healthy, it feels good, it doesn't hurt. And speaking also of how do you love, my love language is affirmative words. So I want to say, like, I love through communication and stuff. So I'm thinking also manifesting joy through resistance, because our joy is resistance. Because they don't want us to be happy. They don't want us to be joyful. They don't want us to have a good time. And so being joyful, being happy, is resistance. Our existence is resistance. Mm-hmm. And so as a community, once we find collective healing, collective liberation, we will, through the process and through the end goal and all of it, is just resistance. We're resisting. Our existence is resistance, and that's something to always remember, really.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love that. I love that a lot. You've also said to me previously that it's important for folks to learn from criticism. what role does accountability play in your own struggles and your community struggles?
So accountability is really, really important.
Mm-hmm.
You need to be aware of your role and your place in where you fit within other people. So what that looks like is also the collective intelligence. So the collective intelligence is us coming together as a community and putting our minds together to solve problems or to solve contradictions. So you don't deal on problems on your own. So if something comes up, tell your community, tell your people, and you can solve it together. Because the person is the product of the colony.
Mm-hmm.
The colony is always, you know, about the individual, the yourself. You just care about yourself and all of those things. And so the person is a product of the colony, and so we need to commit to the collective.
Mm-hmm.
So tap into the collective genius. Ask your community to help you with your problems. If you have an issue, if something comes up, be able to tap into the collective genius, because then it's all of our strength together, all of our skills, all of our talents coming together into, as if it's just one person who is all wise. And this is also, I want to relate it to the shura, the Islamic concept of, you know, coming together, talking about the good and the bad and making a decision together.
Mm-hmm.
Because again, the individual is a product of the colony, and it's liberal to want to deal with issues by yourself, or to this idea of also giving up. I know, like, I'm not saying something about like mental health issues, but because I know that's a big struggle. It's something I've dealt with as well. What I mean is wanting to deal with issues by yourself, or wanting to give up, like, oh, like there's no point, oh, like whatever. So this attitude is very liberal as well, because you're not tapping into the collective genius. You're not reaching out for help from the collective from your community, and you're not going to find liberation through that way.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And it's hard too when we've been taught to be so individual, right?
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Like, how are we supposed to, like, we need to do, like, it's just so hard to be like, okay, I guess I should tap into that collective genius, like, you know. So it takes, there's so much work that goes into being able to ask for help, I think.
No, for sure. I see that, and I've struggled with it as well. I think it's something also that we learn or teach ourselves. So I think it's also part of collective healing. So learning to ask for help is like such an important skill.
Mm-hmm.
And whether help looks like what help can look like. Sometimes you don't even know what you want yourself. But being taught to be an individual it's taught into you as you grow older and older, and especially being in an individualistic society, it's all that they tell you, you know. So it's really hard to break from that. But once you do, you know, you find this healing, you find this tranquility and this love that you sometimes it's so overwhelming that you're like, I don't want to be individual ever, like, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, like you said, it's really difficult to want to break away from that, especially that you're taught and it's in the propaganda everywhere, you know.
So how do you make faith or spirituality your own? What intrigues you the most about the process of doing that?
So like I said before, it's the fluidity of it. And just really realizing that your relationship, your religious or spiritual relationship is very personalized, mm-hmm. depending on you.
Mm-hmm.
So this your relationship with Allah, just kind of like a similar way as to your relationship with anybody else. And it's like that Hadith al-Qudsi about how if you do one step towards Allah, He will come to you running. I really love that, because it's like Allah is the only person or the only being that really sees how much you're trying. I think it's like only you yourself know what you've been through, because you've been through it. Like, you can describe it to other folks, but nobody really knows what it's like except for you. and Allah is the only other person who knows, because Allah is all-knowing, and Allah knows like everything that you have been through. So really focusing on this relationship with Allah also within like within our communities, I think there is a lot of masajid or for LGBTQ folks or marginalized Muslims, that is really cool that you can pray together, and but still there's no room for judgment. There's no room for people to make fun of you or say that you're doing wrong, mm-hmm. what you're doing is wrong. So it's a relationship very individualistic, depending on you and your and Allah, and like how you interact with Allah, and how often you interact with Allah. Another thing again is fluidity, and like I said before, like you don't have to be certain about Islam. If Islam is the right religion, if it feels good, then do it. Mm-hmm. If meditation, because I feel like with Salah, it's always been like I have something I have to do, mm-hmm. and now I'm teaching myself, because I do like through therapy and through meditation, they tell you. I mean, through therapy, they tell you that meditation is good, and that you should take time out of your day to just like focus on yourself and be in the moment and practice mindfulness. And so I'm doing that, but I'm thinking about it and I'm like, it's the exact same thing as Salah, you know? Mm-hmm. But because Salah, I've always been, it's beaten down on me, just like you have to pray on time, whatever. So just rethinking about it in a way and making it fit into what works for me. So praying in the way that works for me. So I see it as a very fluid relationship. And again, like I said, Islam is about decolonizing, because colonization is colonizers are oppressors, and we need to be fighting for the oppressed and be fighting for our right. You know, you have to stand up for yourself. So thinking about Islam in that way has been very helpful for me, and I hope it's helpful for other people to see ourselves grow individually and as a community. And just reimagining our relationship to Islam. I'm not saying just reimagining it, not to say like it's like I'm not really a fan of progressive Islam, because it's like can be Islamophobic, I think, but just reimagining it as in like decolonizing it and seeing it through a lens that's not a colonial lens. So seeing it as it is, like I refuse to believe that the Prophet Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam is like a cruel being. I refuse to believe that he would have stoned the gays or whatever. Like if you read the Quran, if you read the Hadith, he was a very loving being. He was very, very loving and very, very kind and very like generous, and I refuse that he would have done that. Mm-hmm. But I think through colonization and through these cis straight men rewriting everything and interpreting it based on them, that's what it came up to.
Yeah.
So just reimagining it as in going back to the roots. Mm-hmm. Going back to the roots is Allah's the most loving. He's loving. He is kind again and generous and so like. Has such an open and like heart, he's a lovely person. So why would he do those like evil things or like injustices towards people? Mm-hmm. So reimagining it in a way that is not like colonial, mm-hmm. I want to say.
Yeah, I love that a lot. I really resonated with you talking about Salah as like something that can work for you without it being something that you have to do. Like, mm-hmm. like when we reframe the way we think about it, it's like, oh yeah, this is mindfulness. This is helpful. This is something that will ground me if I choose to frame it that way and also participate in that way. And obviously mm-hmm. not to discount like people who have very real triggers with Salah, and, you know.
Yeah, no, I really get that. And I think it's really important as well. When we talk about Salah and mindfulness, being aware that again, our mental health issues are not, are only there because of the colony, mm-hmm. because the world, this world that we're living in, it was not built for us. And so I think like for me, I'm lucky enough to have like a Muslim therapist who is understanding of those issues, who understands that, you know, my mental health issue is not just chemicals or whatever, that it's much deeper. I think that has been really helpful for me. So find out, like, if you can find a decolonial therapist or like somebody you can really relate to, that's also part of your community. That's part of your support system.
Yeah, for sure. What would you like any listening queer Muslims to take away from your stories and your ideas?
To keep going and to keep fighting, because you need to, you cannot give up. Like I said before, like, giving up can be liberal. If you're not, you need to be part of a community. Don't do anything by yourself. Mm-hmm. Don't go through this alone. You're not alone. All of us colonized people are dealing with mental health issues. And so, like, please tap into this collective genius. Please don't go through your problems alone. Please, like, reach out and build your community. If you don't have a, if you don't find a community, organize, be part of a revolutionary organization, find a community for yourself. Remembering that this system isn't built for you is going to relieve pressure, right? And that nobody's meant to be miserable. So don't give up. Just keep fighting. Find your collective and tap into that collective genius, because our togetherness is, and our unity is what's going to save us.
Okay, that's awesome. Is there anything you'd like to plug, or where can folks find you?
You can find me on Facebook, Isma Hammer, or you can find me on Twitter. It's IOVINGEME. It's like loving M, but it's like I. Or on Instagram, Namu, NAMMMMMU. And I just want to say, also, I wanted to say, if you want to be part of my revolutionary organization, to DM me and I will be able to answer any questions. Thank you. I'm really happy to be part of this. I'm honored to be on this podcast and to have this conversation with you.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you. I'm so honored to be here today with you as well. Hello, Taylor, and hello, Nicole.
Hi.
So I really enjoyed my conversation with Ismet. I thought there was a lot that we could work to unpack. I think one thing that I wanted to start off with is the concept of surveillance as stemming from anti-Blackness. So Taylor read the book, I did not, and Taylor did a presentation on the book in one of our classes from last year. Yes, so Taylor will be the one to bring up Simone Brown's Dark Matters, and just the kind of surveillance technology that stems from anti-Blackness.
Yeah, I mean, the book really just looks back at slavery as well as our surveillance practices. So there were, again, it stemmed back from slavery, but also looking at how technology has digitalized surveillance in our cats are playing in the background. So technology has digitalized surveillance, but in a way that we obviously see as racialized in just like whose face is recognized, who is recognized in surveillance technology, digital surveillance technology, and what does that mean for Black people, people of color specifically. And I think the one thing that we, like, I can take away from that is to enslave people, to marginalize people, literally means you need to surveil them. You need to know where they are, what they're doing, and where they want to go so that you can control that in some systematic way. And we see the development, at least Simone Brown documents the development of these surveillance practices from transatlantic slavery, from lantern laws, runaway slave laws, all of these sorts of things that mimic themselves today, but they mimic themselves in the sense that darkness is seen as dangerous. It must be surveilled. And to be surveilled, you must be brought to the light, right? You must clearly and always very clearly identify yourself as somebody who is light. Mm-hmm. And I put quotation marks there because likeness is the absence of darkness. So it's mm-hmm. light as in physical skin color, yeah, but also can we see you, mm-hmm. right? Like who can be easily surveilled? And the idea that to surveil another person, so now we're going to, you know, past slavery, and we can think about our welfare system, we can think about residential schools and how it became you must surveil each other, right? So if you tell me information on somebody else, you'll be protected. You won't get the full length of the consequences.
It's how you survive.
Exactly.
It's not even like that you're going to get rewarded. It's that you're not going to get punished. Mm-hmm.
And that's how the system perpetuates itself, because it's always the idea that we must protect ourselves from an outsider, a foreign outsider that is always in conflict with our goals, our mission, our values, et cetera, et cetera. But what it just turns out to be is to protect yourself so that you feel like you can be safe, so that you feel like the government might have your back, you have to be watching everybody else. Mm-hmm. And it's just a surveillance, like we teach these surveillance practices in our social policy, in what has become normalized, essentially. I mean, Simone Brown doesn't talk about all of the things that I just said, but those ideas, that's where I learned them mm-hmm. from. And if anybody wants to read that book, it is a much clearer depiction, or it provides a much clearer depiction of sort of the transition from the land stolen, Turtle Island that was stolen, and how it became this hyper-surveillance state, and how it perpetuates surveillance of the other. Like you have to make systematic border control. You have to make systematic who's in and who's out, right? Because you're always on guard. You're always, you know, who's the enemy that's against us? And we recognize that because shit is fragile, right? You have to hate somebody else for you to be able to justify your existence. That shit is fragile.
Mm-hmm. So. There was another comment that Ismet made, that Taylor, you were like, wait. And it was a comment about there not being a white working class. And to kind of help listeners understand where Ismet was coming from, I've linked an article in the description titled, "The White Working Class is a Political Fiction. American Media Needs a Better Understanding of Class if We Are to Avoid the Mistakes of the Past," by Adam Theron Lee Wrench. So that'll be there for you if you want to take a further look at that.
FYI, Ismet said a lot of things that I were like, these are hot takes, you know, mm-hmm. like, and hopefully we'll be able to get into some of it, but it's so interesting always, like we all recognize, like we all identify ourselves as radicals in some way, and mm-hmm. identify ourselves as people on the left, so, and not liberal, specifically not liberal, but radical, and yet, there's so much learning that always has to happen. And I think that's the point of this podcast, is to have these conversations, to ask questions, and to question your own stance and your own beliefs. So mm-hmm. We have some hot takes, is all I'm trying to say.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. One of those hot takes was...
It was about protest. Mm-hmm. Nicole, you got some too?
I really found it interesting. What did I write down? I wrote down a lot of stuff. Yeah, in terms of like not going to protests and like educating yourself politically and that sort of thing. And I think that that's true, right? Especially if you, like, I'm white and straight passing, I can go to a protest. Nothing is going to happen to me, most likely, right? And so I think that from... I don't know if this is what Ismet meant, but like my belief is that like people who are there to support marginalized people should show up to these protests because their bodies aren't going to be the ones that might get harmed. Mm-hmm. They should also stay at the back. They should stay at the sides, stay with people if people choose to go. But I can understand being like, no, like take this time to arm yourself, take the time to educate yourself, like mm-hmm. protect yourself, because if you're not protected and you're not around, like you can't help with moving towards a future. And also your life fucking matters. Mm-hmm. They were saying that folks who are marginalized and who these protests are for should stay home and educate themselves. Like your body matters. You as a person matter. And something that I noticed, and it's a lot of it's going to be because of who I am and the fact that I haven't noticed certain microaggressions that have occurred, or like just aggressions that have occurred. But I was really, and I'm aware that we obviously have police brutality in Canada. We have like police brutality and protests and things like that. But like the very real fear of being snatched, when Ismat said that, that was like very, very polarizing. And yeah, like why would you don't go if that's your reality?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, there's some crazy shit happening. Like we all recognize crazy shit happens in Canada all the time. So we mm-hmm. don't have to say Canada's better than the US. Not at all. Absolutely not. If anybody wants to know, fuck Canada. But some crazy shit is happening in protests in America. And when it started, when journalists were getting shot at, when people were getting put in unmarked vans, I was like, yo, like, it's actually the end. Like, you know, some scary shit.
There's this, there's this podcast that I listen to, and I think Maha listens to it too, and Taylor, maybe you listen to it. It's called Behind the Bastards. And Robert, the host of it, has been going to a lot of the protests in Portland, and has been like, there are episodes where he's just like, just being tear gassed, and I'm a little bit like out of it. And I'm like, sorry, what? But what I was going to say is that he also does another podcast with two other folks, and it's called The Worst Year Ever. And it was originally about the election year, and then it turned into a pandemic. But they did an episode where they talked about the civil war that is inevitably going to happen in the US. And what they were saying was, what's really fucked up about this is that affluent white folks, that's not going to feel like it's happening in their country. The civil war happens with like marginalized folks, right? Mm-hmm. So you have to be organized. You have to be protected and things like that. I think I just went on a bit of a tangent, but anywho, that episode blew my fucking mind. And also he was like, I don't think there's going to be as many issues with guns. I might be paraphrasing this wrong. He was like, if everyone gets guns, because everyone's afraid. And that is a terrifying concept.
Yeah. I think for me, so I had a little bit of a, as a black woman, I don't attend that many protests, but I definitely like to show up when possible. And I immediately, when Ismet was like, don't go to protests, I was like, I don't know if I agree with this, you know, like, I think I agree when your government, when you can't trust your government, when you can't trust the people, like, we know we can't trust police, period. But you are fearful of your life going somewhere and getting your voice heard, don't go. Like, your life is more valuable, period. Mm-hmm. I see that. Like, that's a clear line for me. However, my view is that protests are such a valuable way to learn and talk mm-hmm. about things and engage with people. And the protests that I have been to have not looked anything like the protests we see coming from the US and the protests that, especially that we saw this summer. So I say that knowing that, you know, my experience is very different, but I also see them as spaces of sort of like gathering energy. Maha and I went to a vigil on Sunday for Anthony Oust, who was killed by, well, he fell down out of his balcony, but it was a no-knock raid, police violence. We know it, we see it. It happens all the fucking time. Mm-hmm. And in that protest, it hurt. Like, it, you know, I spoke and I was feeling all these emotions, and I was, you know, it was really intense. And then there was an open mic session and people started talking, and, you know, we had the chants and things like that. And it felt a little bit like my spirit and the energy that I got from that space renewed me in some sense. It's painful. It hurts so much. And yet being with people who recognize the urgency, recognize that we're dying, and the how much we need to do, act, makes me feel more renewed and rejuvenated to continue doing that work. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the power of protesting. It's because information gathering and organizing is extremely important. But I'm also very afraid, and Maha and I were talking about this ad nauseum last night, about people isolating themselves and alienating themselves and trying to get information and trying to, you know, understand and figure out what the fuck's going on for themselves. But there's so much disinformation out there. Like, there's so much out there that is actually meant to confuse you, meant to take people away from what really matters. And what really matters is human life, human dignity. Like, we see that, we know that. I think it's something that's in all of us. And the reason I think protesting is powerful is because it's like a very visceral reminder, like, we're here. We're not gonna be quiet. We're not gonna stand by and die. Like, that's just not gonna happen, period. And that's a really powerful learning moment, I think. So that was my whole, like, I was like, I don't know. Like, I feel like, yeah, you can get all that information online. Yeah, you can do all that stuff. And organizing is the most important thing, period. Like, you should be organizing. But for people who aren't organizing, the first place they see and the first place they learn about all that stuff is through pain and rage and heartache. And that comes out in protest.
Mm-hmm. And it sounded like, you know, especially from your experience of the vigil, like, that's where you also find community, mm-hmm. and community grief, community healing, or not even healing, but just community anger. Mm-hmm. Like, that's where you can feel that. And also where you can find people that become your community later.
And you organize, right? Like, it exists. We know what happens. But it's just, I'm just so concerned about people earnestly wanting to get this information and not asking people, not showing up, not putting their bodies on the line, and instead sitting back and getting sucked in a rabbit hole of nonsense, you know?
And there is, like, a very big difference. Like, not every person is an organizer. Mm-hmm. You can't have every person be an organizer. But I also think that Ismat spoke very, very strongly through their experiences of being Palestinian and what happened to their land as well.
Yes.
And, like, the experiences, like, when they spoke about not being organized and things like that. So I can understand why that is, like, of the utmost, like, obviously organizing is incredibly important, but I can also understand for them why it is so, so, so important.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We were listening to a podcast about this recently, actually, mm-hmm. about how, like, strategizing is, like, the most important thing, and without strategy, without organization and strategy, it's kind of like, where are we going? What are we going to do? Because we can always protest. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I agree with all that shit. I think my, and I'm so fascinated in learning, and my research is all about, like, finding those learning spaces and valuing them for what they are. And for me, I see the most important aspect of learning is the relationships that you have with people, mm-hmm. And you develop with people as, like, central to your learning journey. And
and also there was this article called Organizing to Win the World, Addressing the Left's Deficit of Strategic Thinking, that I'll be linking in the episode description. And it was shared by Abolition, a journal of insurgent politics, on Facebook. And the caption is, or I believe it's an excerpt from the article, "If we genuinely want to fundamentally reorganize power in our society, then we have to think long-term about what we're doing and give up on all or nothing answers. This doesn't mean that we can't be firm in our politics, but we have to combine this with planning based on what we want to achieve." So this whole idea that, like, exactly what Ismat was saying in terms of we need organization and preparation in our movements if we want them to be sustainable. Mm-hmm. So I think that was really important.
Absolutely.
So another thing that I really liked about our conversation, or what our conversation reminded me about, was this idea of deliberately placing the future as being a method, a praxis, a framework for healing. So this makes me think of specifically Munoz's book, Cruising Utopia, where he talks about queerness as existing in the realm of the future, and how that, I don't remember this queer theorist's name, so don't at me, but there's someone who wrote a book on like how queer people have no future and how we need to like embrace the present and whatever. And Munoz critiques that idea by being like, well, that's super white.
yeah.
We have to like invest in the what we can't know already, and we have to we have to understand queerness as something that we can't, it's an ideal that you're supposed to try and work towards, and you're constantly reaching for it. But yeah, that's something that I wanted to talk about a little bit in terms of like not centering the future necessarily, but working towards a future as being a praxis of abolition, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Nicole was saying the one thing we've talked about so much in this podcast is learning and like relations and stuff with people. Mm-hmm. But future making is so implicit in everything that we're saying, because mm-hmm. the whole point of struggle is for something better, right? Mm-hmm. Like, otherwise you can be complacent. Otherwise you can say, it's not great, but I don't care, mm-hmm. you know? And the whole point of having these discussions and struggling and asking questions and wanting to learn mm-hmm. and troubling queerness itself, like making queerness something that is not a stable, fixed concept that we can identify.
Mm-hmm. And claim and categorize
is, that is future making, right? Like mm-hmm. you are, in my opinion, destabilizing some easily attainable category or identity or way of being in the world means that you're constantly working for something better. And to mm-hmm. want something better is to look to the future.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's past-based, it's present-based, but it's primarily working for the future. And that's all I can say about it.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. We talk about it so much because it's important. Yeah. It's like the basis of our shit.
Yeah. And like, going off of that, I really liked how Ismet prioritized this sense of unity and community, and like forgiveness, especially as being a part of collective healing, which then turns into collective liberation. Because ultimately we are healing from the collective traumas of colonialism and white supremacy and all their facets. So I really liked how they emphasized how we can transform trauma into healing, into liberation.
I just have a question mm-hmm. on that. Who do y'all think should forgive? Like, who does the forgiving? Do we for all have to forgive each other?
Perhaps. I feel like probably.
But then what are we forgiving?
Well, I feel like that's contextual.
It is contextual, but I just keep thinking, like, forgiveness is always painted as there's someone who's wrong mm-hmm. and there's someone who's right.
Mm-hmm.
And the person who's wrong needs to ask forgiveness to the person who's right.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. I think we all recognize that it's never that easy. It's never so binary.
Well, yeah, and there's always times where we have to take accountability and ask for forgiveness ourselves as well, right?
I think, you know, just maybe to answer my own question, I think we have to also think about forgiving ourselves mm-hmm. for our failures, for our...
That's something that's so fucking hard.
For our humanness. Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. We have to be able to forgive ourselves for our humanness and not... And, you know, this is not maybe... Look, this is not exactly what we were talking about, and this is another hot take that y'all may disagree with me on, but I was watching a YouTube video, and I don't remember her name, and this person was saying, like, I disagree with cancel culture, blah, 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 this Black woman, and trying to explain why mm-hmm. Cancel culture and the idea of this person being out, we're done with them, is not helpful at all. And I think it comes back to that idea of forgiveness, mm-hmm. right? Like if we can recognize and if we can normalize being human, being imperfect, mm-hmm. not having to know everything, not having to be right all the time, and that is an aspect that we start from, then it perhaps maybe might be easier for us to make mm-hmm. mistakes, accept our mistakes, and move on from them mm-hmm. instead of sort of holding down on our beliefs, even when yes. we know that they're wrong, and even when we know that they cause harm because we're ashamed, mm-hmm. because we feel alienated or isolated. And that starts with forgiving yourself, mm-hmm. first off. It starts mm-hmm. with forgiving yourself. But forgiveness is something that we don't frequently prioritize in our movements. Like sometimes we're so on the go in terms of this is what needs to happen. These are the beliefs. These are the standards that we must uphold, and anyone who doesn't uphold them can't be part of it. And yeah, that's right. Especially when you're talking about safety and life and security. But I think we also need to start talking about, so how do we rehabilitate? How do we heal from this? And exactly as Ismet said, a lot of that is in, you know, unity and forgiving and community. And it's something that is underrated. We don't talk about it enough. So, mm-hmm.
yeah. And you can't have forgiveness without accountability. Mm-hmm. So,
yes.
You have to forgive yourself. And if you forgive mm-hmm. yourself, you have to be accountable to the harm that you have caused.
Mm-hmm. You have to acknowledge that forgiving is hard. It's not something easy. Like just being like, yeah, no, I'm over it. That's not enough. Like we're talking about like true forgiveness and true accountability, truly taking responsibility for your actions as well if you do get called out, because that's how you grow. If you're just going to be defensive,
like, okay, so the way I see it is, if someone does me harm, right, mm-hmm. I can still be working through the harm that is caused and forgive that person.
Yes,
because in my opinion, forgiveness is seeing the opportunity for change, for better,
for growth
absolutely,
or you know, and that means that it doesn't necessarily to me mean that shit is gone. It's over and done with, but it is a recentering from like, you've done me harm, to how do we get transformative justice? Mm-hmm. How do we work from that harm to do something better? Mm-hmm. I think that's what I understand. And like, again, like we're not taught that. You're taught like you forgive someone and it's done. Right, like you never mention it again.
Mm-hmm. That's what I meant by like true forgiveness. Mm-hmm. Absolutely, because I don't believe in forgiving and forgetting, because I think forgetting can also be really harmful. Mm-hmm. And like, especially if something that happened really affected you, like you shouldn't forget, but you should be able to forgive and find a way to move past it that's healthy for the people involved.
Mm-hmm. And that's why Ismet mentioned it as a collective thing, like mm-hmm. as collective healing, because it's not just a person who harm was done to, and not just a person who does the harm. Like it takes, and again, like when we think about transformative justice, and when we think about what we really want when we talk about transformative justice, it is collective working to reduce that harm, to make better the life of the person who did harm, the person who received harm or was harmed, and the people all incidental in that as well. Like, mm-hmm. so it's not just the action, but the systems. Mm-hmm.
I was gonna add, it's not just about making the, or like reducing harm, mm-hmm. but preventing harm.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. So it moves mm-hmm. beyond the harm. It moves beyond harm, mm-hmm. essentially. But we are talking about why harm is done and how do we move to prevent it.
Mm-hmm. I guess to end, I'd like to talk about the thing that Ismet said about not being able to worship Allah if you're at war with yourself. Mm-hmm. Because I took that to heart. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that means that we can't use faith in God to heal ourselves when we're in bad places. But the faith is harder when you're at war with yourself. And I'm slowly getting there. I feel like it'll be a lifelong journey for me and for many folks. Mm-hmm. But yeah.
Thanks for listening to another episode of Queer Muslim Resistance. If you were interested in our conversation on surveillance, check out Nazar, an independent journalism project on surveillance launched and curated by Vanessa Taylor, a Black Muslim journalist. As always, you can find relevant links and further reading in the episode description. Make sure to check us out on Instagram for links to our Queer Muslim Resource Guide, to Tarif, a Queer Muslim reading group, and for awesome Queer Muslim content in general. You can email us at queermuslimresistance@gmail.com for any inquiries, additional resources you'd like to see added to the resource guide, or just to say hi.